kresge.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with a local activist about a radical proposal for Tampa's Bayshore Boulevard, the scene of a heartbreaking accident 2 weeks ago where a mother and her baby daughter were killed by two young men who were street racing. And later, we're going to talk with conservative author Jonah Goldberg, who's going to be speaking in St. Petersburg next week. Well, first, two cars racing up Bayshore Boulevard 2 weeks ago at speeds of more than 100 miles an hour mowed down and killed 24-year-old Jessica Robineau and her 21-month-old daughter Lilia. They were walking along Bayshore. They were visiting from Ohio. Since then, there have been calls to do something to reduce the danger to pedestrians along the scenic four-lane roadway in downtown Tampa. And we're joined by an activist who's proposed some changes to Bayshore Boulevard. He lives in the neighborhood. He is Alex Engelman. Engelman recently launched a website called TakeBackBayshore.com that calls for shutting down the two waterside lanes between West Hawthorne Road, just north of Gandy, and West Swan Avenue. Metal gates would be installed at those points and at 33 intersections on the grassy median to create a safe space for bikers and pedestrians while allowing for occasional traffic like emergency vehicles. And Alex, welcome to WMNF. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming by.
Rob, thank you for having me and for having both Take Back Bayshore and MakeBayshoreSafe.org, our sister site here, both linked to the same change.org petition. Walking in the door, hitting refresh, 5,100 plus signatories in less than 2 weeks.
That's pretty quick.
So we're getting some traction, and turns out Tampa's a pretty empathic place. People care about Bayshore, they care about road safety, and the outpouring of sympathy has been really impressive. We are a forum for their voices.
Well, how did you get involved in this? Why did you decide to take this up as a cause?
You know, I think like anyone in Tampa, when you see such a tragedy, especially in a young family, a child injured or killed, you know, immediately you want to do something to memorialize them and make sure it never happens again. So I know Nick Friedman, my partner in this, we both have young kids. I think that I can speak for him in saying, as soon as I heard the news, you say a prayer for Jessica and Lilia, and then you think about your own two kids. I've got a four-year-old and a two-year-old boy, and blink an eye, and they're making a break for the curb. Walking on Bayshore, that can be a very deadly proposition. I think we forget that Bayshore is a residential street. So this is a boulevard sandwiched between a city park and a residential street. And our drive here is that it's been treated like a highway for too long.
Mm. So what would you actually like to do? I mentioned your website and briefly what you'd like to do. How would you describe what you want to do on Bayshore?
You know, Rob, you mentioned metal gates. We want to close the waterside lanes and make a true city park. There are so many ideas by so many people much better than I at city design and urban planning, and all of them have been speaking out on this. I was at a meeting just last night, and you could feel the heat coming out of the room when we went through the presentations and showed the Grand Boulevard concept, the Greenway Trail concept, the transit corridor concept, the cycling running track path with a synthetic track concept. There's so many things you could do there that link so many parts of this city and capture the natural beauty that is Bayshore. Mm. You know, it's when you talk about Bayshore, of course, one of the things you have to talk about is the commute. We'd love to see waterside lanes closed. We'd love to see Tampa join the growing movement in the nation that's recapturing misused or underused civic and community resources like the High Line in New York, the LA River Revitalization Project. Chattanooga is a good example. These projects exist across the country. All of them have tremendous economic benefit. All of them have tremendous civic benefit in terms of active public gathering places. We'd like to capture that and simultaneously help commuters. This is a pedestrian safety issue, but this is also a traffic safety issue too.
Well, all right. So how would you help commuters? Because this is, if you're going to close down Bayshore Boulevard from essentially four lanes below Rome Avenue to two lanes, this is a road that people use to get from the east side of town and the north side of town to MacDill Air Force Base, and from St. Petersburg in the Gandy area to get to the hockey games and to get to activities in downtown like the Straz Center and get to work. You're going to affect people coming both ways, both north and south, because it is a commuter road right now.
You know, one of the things that blew my mind yesterday was what we have to work with here. So think about two intersections in the city, Kennedy at Ashley, major downtown interchange, and Bayshore at South Boulevard. Incidentally, both carry 34,000 cars average daily use. Kennedy at Ashley has an 80-foot width road span. Bayshore at South Boulevard and all along Bayshore, 130 to 160 feet.
Wow.
You can do it all. There is space for all of it. I would love to see a 25-mile-an-hour, two-lane scenic byway, but my voice is not the only voice here. We got to get the men and women in service to whom we owe all our lives and our safety to and from MacDill, full stop. We got to continue the growth and vibrancy of downtown, but this is not to the one is not to the exclusion of the other. It's interesting, the county's projections for 2040, when you look at a map of the South Tampa Peninsula, there's a color code that they give in terms of how much volume they expect on certain roadways and what the capacity of those roadways are. There is only one north-south road or artery in the South Tampa Peninsula projected to have capacity that exceeds its volume in 2040, and that's the Selman Expressway. It's an ideal setup to get to and from MacDill. I would love to see Bayshore reduced in volume. If you do, I think that's a great way to direct traffic to an artery that can accommodate that volume safely, where you don't have the risk to pedestrians, you don't have the risk to bicyclists. And if there needs to be alteration in the toll structure, if we as a community need to support our men and women in arms and offset some of the toll costs, I am happy to do that, but that needs to be a part of the discussion.
Well, we're talking with Alex Engelman, who, along with some other folks, has put up a website called TakeBackBayshore.com, and it's in response to the tragic death of a young woman and her young daughter 2 weeks ago along Bayshore Boulevard in South Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. So the solution to the traffic going to MacDill or into downtown to go to the hockey games or go to Channelside or go to the Straz Center or the Tampa Theater, the solution is to move that traffic over to the Selman Expressway.
Not only that, I think that's one of the solutions. We've also heard the ferry concept that's been floated around, fantastic idea. We've also have a history of Bayshore of public transit. A trolley, a streetcar, ran on Bayshore for many decades. It was decommissioned in 1946. You know, the history of you mentioned at the very opening, the radical idea. This could not be further from the truth. The history of Bayshore is a public gathering place. The shore of our bay at the mouth of the Hillsborough River has always been a gathering place for people as long as people have been here. The history here is not one of a road. The history is one of a natural resource that the community enjoys. In the late 19th century, the boulevard was conceived of by the Chapin family, and the very first thing they did was install that trolley car system that ran down to the Ballast Point Pavilion at the end of Bayshore. In the early 20th century, Bayshore got connected to downtown, and that trolley continued to operate. In the earliest 20th century, Bayshore had a beach and a natural spring-fed pool from Palmacia Springs at today's Fred Ball Park.
You can't even tell that spring was there.
There's a little well. That's about it.
That is very sad.
Yeah. But when you see these concept drawings, think Rio de Janeiro. Plug a beach right into a waterside park, main artery, with transit, with recreation facilities. There's room to do it all there. This is a radical, quote unquote, radical idea, but this is actually the history of Bayshore.
What about emergency traffic? If somebody is in South Tampa and they need to go to Tampa General Hospital, let's say an ambulance, or maybe, you know, you're driving your spouse because she's pregnant and the baby's due, you're going to Tampa General, you have an emergency, your child broke at the arm. How do you get there quickly on a two-lane road?
Well, part of Bayshore, in terms of keeping it open for pedestrians and public transit, is having the ability to utilize that space when needed for these ticker tape events like Gasparilla.
So you would leave the road there. You wouldn't pave it.
I wouldn't pull it all up. I think you need some pavement there.
Yeah.
And whether that's for use by emergency vehicles and maintenance crews, and then reuse during the Pirate Fest invasion, during the Distance Classic, during the On Bikes events, during the number of events where we already closed Bayshore, you need to retain that capacity. There are many different controls here, but there is room for design in terms of sheer width. And there is such a history in the nation right now, such a trend towards creating these multimodal public spaces.
We're talking with Alex Engelman, who's with the website TakeBackBayshore.com, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. What would be the speed limit? I mean, the city has already reduced the speed limit on Bayshore from 40 to 35.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, and big shout out to the TPD. You know, enforcement was already up before this tragedy, and since then they've been a huge presence there on Bayshore. We want to see more of that. We have some short-term asks. Credit also goes to the mayor's office. You know, he and his team, Gene Duncan in Transportation and Stormwater, have a track record here of committing to the waterfront and Julian B. Lane Park, the Riverwalk, you know, connecting these arteries. Bayshore is part of the health and wellness concept of downtown living that Water Street is a good emblem of, in terms of the College of Medicine coming down. And I know, I spoke today with a spokeswoman from his office, I know they are committed to joining those projects together for thematic unity of health, wellness, and capturing our natural beauty there.
You're talking about the Vinnick Project.
The Vinnick Project, yeah. But you know, Bayshore in particular as the main artery there.
Would the speed limit is now down to 35. Would you take it even further down?
I would. I would love to see it at 25. And of course, there are people that there are needs that we have to accommodate. This, like I mentioned, is a roadway that runs between a city park and a residential street. Think of any other street in Tampa that runs between a park and a house where you can go over 35. You can't. It's not. It should not be a divided highway. It should be a scenic byway, in my opinion. But there's ways to accommodate volume without necessarily dropping to 25, and there's good precedent for it. Let's talk about Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. 34,000 cars on Bayshore at South Boulevard. Rock Creek Parkway, 77,800 average daily cars, more than double. It runs right through a national park. And 6.1 miles of it, longer than the stretch of Bayshore, is completely closed to vehicular traffic on weekends. So there's a good precedent for still retaining use. Rock Creek Parkway is not a wide street, but it alternates traffic flows. In the morning, it's coming in the evening, it's going out. You could do the same thing for the McDill commute. You could do the same thing for Lightning games. You could do the same thing for city events. I think there's room to accommodate all things. Part of this, though, in terms of speed limit, we can dream of whatever park we want right on the water. You got to get to Bayshore. You got to get across Bayshore. So part of this is committing to all the feeder neighborhoods and streets that come into Bayshore, Beta Bay, Rome, Euclid, El Prado, and all the business districts too that can both see the benefit of a more walkable and transit-friendly Bayshore that see the economic boom there and then feed into it. So part of it's committing to those neighborhoods and those design projects, and part of it is crosswalks. At the spot of this most recent tragedy, you would have to walk 20 minutes to get to a painted crosswalk. 20 minutes just to get to paint on the street. You know, there have been a lot of concepts to roll out in terms of flashing beacons and ways to slow traffic and calm traffic, narrow travel lanes, protect bike paths. I think that those are fantastic. And that's part of the expedited plan from the city. There's a Bayshore Safety Action Plan that they're going to do those types of things that we just described. We'd like to see more. We'd like to see a lower speed limit. We'd like to see enhanced enforcement with speed cameras, with enhanced penalties for speeders on Bayshore and other streets within the Vision Zero Corridors project that have higher fatality rates than Bayshore.
What is the Vision Zero's Corridors project?
Vision Zero is the concept that the right number of pedestrian fatalities on a roadway is zero. And it is a book of design elements and concepts that shift the priority from traffic volume to the consideration of the proximity and the priority of pedestrians and their safety. So Vision Zero is something that the county has committed to, something that the city council recognizes. They are guiding principles that the mayor's office is working by. Part of our goal here is to have an interagency agreement and commitment to those design principles when building new roads across the city, because Bayshore is far from the most deadly road. It's one of the most prominent, and it's a place where we as a community can say to the nation that we are committed to a safer travel environment and revaluing our natural resources and our public spaces. But this concept of designing our roads so they're safe for pedestrians should be a guiding principle across our agencies, and that commitment should have teeth to it.
We're talking with Alex Engelman, and he started a website called TakeBackBayshore.com, and we're talking about possible changes to Bayshore Boulevard in Tampa. Paul writes this. He said, time to slow down these cars. We need to reclaim this boulevard for pedestrian and bicycle use. He writes, and then he said, let folks use the crosstown that runs parallel to this road. That's what it was built for, rapid movement of traffic. I'm all for a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit with a lane reduction, writes Paul. Paul, thanks a lot. And here's an email from 352 area code. He says, is your guest aware that Kennedy Boulevard does not have a 20-foot wide median like Bayshore Boulevard does?
Yes, of course. Bayshore does have a large median. It doesn't have to. It is a blank slate. And it almost was last year when we were expecting 25-foot storm surges. We almost had the opportunity forced upon us to redesign Bayshore. God forbid that should happen. Let's have a plan in place. Let's do it ourselves as opposed to being forced to do it. That 25-foot median is beautiful. I would love to keep it as part of the plan here. It can be shifted. It can be moved. The city has moved mountains in creating our Riverwalk and the regrowth and re-energization of downtown. We can move a median also.
Let's go to DJ in Tampa. And Alex, you're going to have to put on those headphones over there. DJ is in Tampa. DJ, what's your question for Alex?
Rob, great morning. This smells so good checking in. Hey, I got, I'm just kind of dumbfounded. Why, if I'm 40 years old and Walt Disney's been around over 50 years and they're supposed to be in the land of tomorrow and they have a working monorail system, why isn't that monorail system being connected throughout the Tri-County states? That long corridor that you got running up and down the interstate, that's perfect to go ahead and cut that out and run the monorail system straight up and down the interstate along with solar-powered sidewalks. It makes no sense that we got all these beautiful sidewalks that we can be utilizing, just like these other countries are already set the model and showed us.
DJ, thanks a lot. Thanks for your comment. Yeah. I should say that there is a guy in Tampa who we've had on before who wants to have a monorail. I've invited him back, so we'll see if he comes back. This email from Bill says, one wonders why no one talks about speed bumps. Are speed bumps part of your proposal?
They have not been initially, and that's just because of the track record in the last year or so in terms of the city's interest in building more speed bumps. I think it's a fantastic idea. We are trying to be realistic in terms of affecting the most immediate change, because it's a question of statistics, unfortunately. And I hate saying that because I was in a meeting last night and 1-2 weeks ago with a young woman, a very vibrant young woman who was hit on Bayshore, flew 35 feet and live to tell the tale. Mm. And she employs that term when she describes herself. She's one of the statistic. Mm. And the numbers are belie the hard reality that these are young mothers with babies. And these are our friends. These are our family. I want to say this, Rob, before we talk about the numbers. This was a guest in our home. If our sense of civic duty and public pride and environmentalism haven't been enough motivation for us to make these changes, how about our Southern hospitality? How about the fact that this was a guest from out of state in our home and we failed her and her baby?
Alex, we've only got 3 minutes left. I want to ask you, there's an MPO meeting, Hillsborough Metropolitan Planning Organization meeting this coming Tuesday. Are you going to be at that meeting?
Yes, our group will be at that meeting.
What are you going to be calling for?
You'll hear from Nick Friedman. Immediate goals and some long-term vision here. We're going to be calling for a public safety and pedestrian safety study on Bayshore with public input to specifically address the option of closing those waterfront lanes and the involvement of public-private partnerships, because we've had a large showing of commitment from many businesses and many of these local districts. So part of that is committing to the idea of recapturing Bayshore as a public park. We also want safety right now. You know, the Bayshore Safety Action Plan is to be commended. The urgency and how that motion was expedited is great. We want to see the speed limit lowered even further to 25. We want to see those speed cameras. We want to see enhanced enforcement. We want to see paint on the roads south of Beta Bay. We want to see crosswalks. Paint crosswalks. They're calling for flashing beacons. I think there should be red light beacons. There should be hard stop beacons.
Actual stops. Yeah.
Actual stops. Yeah. You know, the law says that if the pedestrian's in the crosswalk, they have the right of way. Pedestrian, of course, can't jump out in front of a car that doesn't have time to stop. It's catch 22 on Bayshore. Try to find time to get out in front of a car. Nick took a cell phone video the other day. Two young girls sitting there in the median, inches from tragedy on either side for over a minute, trying to get across the road in a place with a ramp clearly designated for them to cross. Yeah. They just couldn't do it. So, and we also want to see public input on all those neighboring projects that involve Vision Zero principles. We also should mention the Complete Streets, which is another way of rethinking about the design of streets to include Beta Bay, to include all those feeder streets, and in a larger sense, the streets identified most recently by a meeting of the neighborhood association presidents of many neighborhoods throughout Tampa, where they pool the input from their residents and identify these areas that are threats to our safety.
Alex, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. If people want to find out more, when is the MPO meeting? What time is it Tuesday?
That's this Tuesday at 6 p.m. in County Center. It's 601 East Kennedy Boulevard on the second floor. Show up, let your voice be heard.
All right, and your website is takebackbayshore.com.
It is.
All right, Nick Engelman, Alex Engelman, thank you so much for coming by WMNF. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Alex. This is WMNF in Tampa. Music from Oliver Mitikudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, Jonah Goldberg is a senior editor at National Review and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He was a prominent Never Trumper during the 2016 primary campaign. In his 2008 book, Liberal Fascism, he suggested that Democrats are the real racists and argued that fascism was really a left-wing idea. In his new book, The Suicide of the West, it's been called a conservative classic. He says the rebirth of tribalism, populism, nationalism, and identity politics is destroying American democracy. And speaking of populism, Goldberg is a big fan of the classic film A Face in the Crowd, starring Andy Griffith, in which Griffith stars as a homespun populist who's given a TV show that evil business people hope to use to leverage to take over the country. Here's the moment in the film when the populist, Lonesome Rhodes, played by Andy Griffith, who's drunk on the power of his media influence, is revealed to be a fake. Let's see if we can pull this up.
Hello, thanks to syndication,
on
it's one of
there.
The few television series that seem to be in a real...
I can take chicken fertilizer instead of milk and caviar. I can make them eat dog food and I think it's steak. Sure, I got them like this.
You know what the public's like, a cage full of guinea pigs.
Good night, you stupid idiot. Good night, you miserable slob.
There are a lot of trained seals. I toss them a dead fish and they'll flap their flippers.
Well, Jim, so close a walk with thee.
Well, that's a scene from the movie A Face in the Crowd where Lonesome Rhodes, played by Andy Griffith, is revealed to be a fake populist. And we're joined now by Jonah Goldberg, who's written a new book about populism called Suicide of the West. And Jonah Goldberg, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
So, you know, Jonah, I was really surprised that A Face in the Crowd was one of your favorite films because I thought that Andy Griffith character was Donald Trump. I mean, I thought that Elia Kazan had looked into the future, and Donald Trump is drunk on the power of the media, and he was just, Elia Kazan was just predicting what was going to happen 60 or 70 years into the future.
Well, I mean, obviously, he wasn't actually thinking about Donald Trump, right?
Yeah.
You mean figuratively rather than literally.
Exactly.
But I don't know why it would surprise you that I, you know, would like the movie. I've been writing against populism, both in liberal fascism, which I think you slightly mischaracterized. I don't say that Democrats are all racist or anything like that, but I've been writing against populism for something like 20 years, and I've never liked it. The only exception I've ever had was for the Tea Parties, because they seem to defy the standard model of populism, and eventually they succumb to the standard model of it, which I thought was a tragedy. But generally speaking, I think populism runs against the finest parts of the American tradition. And look, I think the comparison to Donald Trump is apt. That's one of the reasons I picked that film when I did that Turner Classics movie episode. I used to call him a Lonesome Rhodes in a $10,000 suit. The problem with populism is, or there are lots of problems with it, but inherent to almost all forms of populism is this idea that we the people really isn't all of the people. It's just a faction of them. And it puts their demands and feelings above arguments, above reason, above debate. My favorite line comes from William Jennings Bryan, where, you know, one of the great populists of the 19th century, and he said, the people of Nebraska are for free silver, therefore I am for free silver. I will look up the arguments later. And I think Donald Trump taps into a lot of that. Elia Kazan, you know, you got to remember, I can't remember, what was the date of the movie? 52? Something
yeah,
like
55,
that?
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, so, I mean, the memories of Father Coughlin, who was the, you know, the famous supposedly right wing, even though he was to the left of FDR, Radio Priest and Huey Long and those guys, populism was a real fresh memory in American life, and TV was just coming into its own. And I think Elie Kazan brilliantly spotted that what could have been done with radio could be done much more powerfully with television. And I think it's indisputable that, you know, the one of the reasons, I don't think it's the only reason, there are some other ones, but one of the reasons we got Donald Trump in the first place is because of the power of television, and specifically the power of celebrity to override the sort of traditional norms and mechanisms of American politics. He broke the blood-brain barrier between entertainment and politics in ways that nobody else had. And I think that's a dangerous, whatever you think about Donald Trump, you can be for him, you can be against him, you can be sort of in the middle, as I sometimes am. This precedent, I think, is going to vex American politics and American life for a very long time to come, because once this precedent is set, you can see how lots of other people who can essentially buy fame or celebrity are saying to themselves, if Trump can do it, I can do it. And that's a dangerous thing.
How would you describe left-wing populism? Give us some examples. How would you describe right-wing populism? Give us some other examples beyond Trump.
Sure. I mean, first of all, let me just sort of say that, you know, the left-wing, right-wing thing can get awfully muddy and misleading, because I think the true north is basically essentially classical liberalism, which holds that the individual is sovereign, that you know, our rights come from God, not from government, that the whole point of democracy is disagreement, not agreement, and that we should have deliberation and debate rather than foment this sort of herd mentality that says the mob should rule. And that's what I think populism basically is. It's the logic of the mob. But, you know, left-wing populism, Bernie Sanders was on the populist wing of the Democratic Party. You know, Father Coughlin, despite the fact that he was an anti-Semite, and for a lot of people seem to think that anti-Semitism makes you right-wing.
I certainly think that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, take it up with Jeremy Corbyn. There are a lot of left-wing anti-Semites out there. You know, there's a reason why anti-Semitism was...
Well, Corbyn's not left-wing on the issue of Judaism. He's left-wing on the issue of the human rights of the Palestinians.
Yeah, I disagree. I think he tolerates a remarkable amount of anti-Semitism. But look, you can find other examples of left-wing anti-Semites out all over the place, including people like Linda Sarsour, to the Bolsheviks under Stalin. It's pretty easy. But if you want to take anti-Semitism out of it, you know, Father Coughlin supported the New Deal. He said it was Roosevelt or ruin in the 1932 campaign.
But then he turned on Roosevelt later on and was one of Roosevelt's harshest critics.
Because Roosevelt was too right-wing for him. He wasn't socialist enough. This is one of these great myths in American political history, that he moved to FDR's right. He moved, if you read the Social Justice Platform, which he ran for, which he promoted across the country, it was way to the left of FDR's New Deal. And so there's one example. I don't know. You can come up with all sorts of right-wing examples.
Well,
I think.
When you say mob, though, aren't these really movements? When you talk about, let's say, the folks that supported Bernie Sanders, this is a movement. It represents the aspirations of 10, 20, 30%, 40% of the country, whatever it represents. But it's not the whole country. It's not a takeover of the country. It's just a push. It's a push on the body politic.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm not trying to demonize Bernie Sanders, but there have always been left-wing variants of populism, and there have been what we've called right-wing variants of populism. I don't like either side. You know, the Occupy Wall Street was a populist movement. It was arguing that that America was split between the 99% and the 1%, which I thought was fairly ridiculous on a bunch of different grounds. But historically, sort of left-wing populists are much more sort of, they're not necessarily Marxist Bolshevik communists, but they are, you know, dedicated to sort of much more sort of socialist forms of economics, whether you want to call it social democracy or whatnot. They're for seizing the means of production much more than people on the right. Various forms of right wing populism, you know, they take, you know, sort of, you could say that, what's his name? George Wallace was a right wing populist. And it's worth remembering that there were a lot of conservatives, particularly places like National Review, that were foursquare against Wallace and thought he was a dangerous demagogue.
But now Steve Bannon is a right-wing populist.
He's a right-wing populist, and I think he's a very bad dude.
Okay.
I think also he's sort of a fool, but he's a very bad dude, and what he is encouraging, I think, is incredibly dangerous and dumb. And it's interesting, in the latest interview, he's talking about how, or one of his recent interviews, he's talking about how you know, his economic nationalism needs to incorporate sort of the Bernie Sanders socialism. And this gets to sort of one of my basic points in my first book, is that, you know, we're taught in schools that nationalism and socialism are opposite phenomena, and they're really just not. You can take the speeches of Fidel Castro and replace the, you know, the words for socialism or socialized with nationalism and nationalize, and the sentences don't change anything. Nationalized healthcare is socialized medicine. These impulses, they take on different cultural valences depending on who the members of these populist movements are, but invariably populism leads to this idea, just like nationalism, because nationalism and populism are very closely related. They lead to this idea that we, the people, the masses, need to take over the levers of government and interfere in the economy and in public life in ways that will allegedly unify us all. And I stand athwart that, whether you call it right-wing or left-wing.
We're talking with Jonah Goldberg, who is the author of a brand-new book called Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. He is a writer for the National Review. He'll be speaking next Thursday at the Tiger Bay Club at the St. Pete Yacht Club. And for more information, you can go to tigerbay.org. But, you know, if nationalism and socialism are the same thing, why did Hitler round up communists and labor activists and socialists first? I mean, that's who he rounded those folks up before he went after the Jews.
Yeah, you know, but that's something that totalitarians do in every society. Totalitarians clamp down on any competing institutions that are opposed to their rule. You know who killed a lot of socialists and closed down a lot of unions? Stalin. When people want to make this argument that Hitler was right-wing because he did X, one of the first questions I always like to ask is, okay, what did Stalin do with regard to X? And invariably, the distinctions are very, very small. There were no independent labor unions in the Soviet Union. I don't think there are any independent labor unions in China today. There certainly weren't under Mao.
But you could say Stalin was nuts in that the real, you know, the real heroes of that revolution were Trotsky and Lenin, but they were deposed, right?
Yeah,
or at least Lenin died and then Trotsky was deposed.
Lenin were murderers, too.
Well,
we had
right.
No problem
okay,
murdering
well,
lots and lots of people.
You know, I want to talk about your new book. I'm sorry. You know, I would love to talk to you for an hour about this, but let me get to your new book. In your new book, you write that human rights, democracy, and capitalism are unnatural. What do you mean by unnatural?
Right. So one of the things I am trying to do is get people to appreciate just how miraculous and special and weird the last 300 years are compared to the previous 250,000 years of history. You can pick a date, 1680s, whatever you want to do. We've kind of stumbled into a new way of organizing society. It unfolded slowly and imperfectly, and it had a lot of vestigial things that needed to be worked out, things like slavery and the treatment of women and all of that. But inherent into what I call this Lockean revolution was this idea that the individual is sovereign, that our rights come from God, not from government, that our property belongs to us, that the government is there to serve us, we're not there to serve it. For almost all of human history, governments self-conceived of themselves as essentially cartels to take care of themselves and improve their own lot, and they didn't really care about the serfs and the peasants and everybody else. And I'm using the language of the left here, but I have no problem with it. Things like human rights, natural rights, property rights, free speech, all of these things are social constructs. They did not appear, or at least not appear for very long, in the record of humanity in any society anywhere. For hundreds of thousands of years, and then we stumbled into them, and that is what has created the greatest explosion in prosperity humanity has ever seen. For 250,000 years, the average human being everywhere in the world lived on no more than $3 a day, and then once and only once did that start to change. And we're living in that moment right now, where these last 30 years have been the greatest period of poverty alleviation in all of human history. And it's because of what I call the miracle, this idea of markets and individual rights and popular sovereignty. And what the reason why it's important to point out that it's unnatural is that nature, you know, human nature in particular, always tries to reclaim what it sees as hers. If you put, you know, a grandfather clock in a field and you leave it there, within a decade, it's going to be returned to the soil for the most part. And what is required for a civilization to stay on the kind of path that we're on is constant upkeep and vigilance to hold human nature at bay. Because human nature, things like nepotism, monarchy, sort of demonizing of others, these things are all natural. They're all part of our natural wiring. And what a civilization does is it holds human nature at bay or channels it in productive ways. And when we don't teach people how special and how grateful we should be for the civilization that we have, we open up space for entitlement and resentment to come in. And I think as an educational policy, as a cultural policy, we basically teach people to take everything that we have for granted and to actually teach people to be resentful towards our civilization, which I think is a suicidal choice.
Well, now you're beginning to sound like a liberal. I mean, that sounds like a very anti-libertarian philosophy. What you just stated, would you agree with that?
I think there are problems with the. I certainly think there are deep and abiding problems with the Randian model. You know, the Ayn Rand model that the individual is, you know, essentially, you know, the Ubermensch, and that you should be able to use your will to get whatever you want. At the federal level, I'm remarkably libertarian, but at the local level, I'm remarkably communitarian, because in reality, people don't live in the United States of America. They live in families and they live in communities. And those things are vital to maintaining a healthy society and to create citizens. And so I have a lot of criticism of the market in my book. You know, Joseph Schumpeter predicted that capitalism would give way to some form of sort of statism or socialism precisely because the market wears down, it doesn't just wear down evil institutions like slavery and the divine right of kings. It also wears down positive institutions like the family. And so you need to have a sort of cultural program that respects the role of community. It respects the fact that people need to have a sense of dignity and a place in the world. And not all of that can be done by government. A lot of it has to be done at the ground level.
Well, what are you talking about, though? You're talking about religious institutions?
Religious institutions are hugely important. The family is hugely important. Mediating institutions, mediating structures. You know, Robert Putnam, a good liberal Harvard sociologist.
Bowling alone?
Yeah. Yep. He did a massive, over 30,000 person survey, and he found that that increased levels of sort of ethnic diversity in neighborhoods were corrosive to civil society, and not because of racism. He found that, and he hated his results, so he waited a year to see if he could falsify them, and he couldn't. The problem is that when you have people no longer being active participants in their communities because they don't understand their neighbor's language or they don't understand their customs, they tend to hunker down and look to the state to solve their problems rather than adjudicating them themselves. And that's deeply pernicious. Even more pernicious and compounding of the problem is that we tend to retreat to places like Facebook and cable news, which accelerate these trends and confirm our worst tendencies. And we start to see people who disagree with us, not as human beings, but as sort of evil people who must be punished. Because what we get on places like Facebook and Twitter is all of this confirmation of our worst instincts and this tend towards demonization. And it's a bipartisan problem.
Yeah, well, I agree. Jonah Goldberg is a senior editor at National Review, and he's the author of a brand new book called Suicide of the West. He'll be coming to St. Petersburg next Thursday. You can find out more going to tigerbay.org. He'll be speaking at the Tiger Bay Club at noontime at the St. Pete Yacht Club. Jonah, aren't you talking, though, about a problem that is endemic to America? I mean, if you go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was all that anti-Catholic sentiment. There certainly was anti-Semitism, but there was anti-Asian sentiment. People thought that these new immigrants, the Catholics, the Italians, the Germans, were not going to fit in. For the first generation, they stayed in their enclave. And then you find out, over time, now you can't tell the difference between the Catholics and the Jews and the Italians. I mean, a lot of people can't tell the difference, that the society just melds together. And there's all these stories, at least I grew up Catholic, all these stories about the Catholic mass for the Italians at 8 a.m. and then the Catholic mass for the Spanish at 9 a.m. and then the Catholic Mass for the Germans at 10 a.m. And when one group left the church, they would throw rocks at the church because they didn't like the ethnic group inside. And they thought these newcomers, they didn't like them. But we got over that.
Yeah, I agree we got over that. And it's a glorious thing that we got over that. But at the same time, you had people going to Mass. and you had institutions, you know, you had parish priests who tried to smooth out these things. You also had a culture and an education system that taught assiduously the benefits of assimilation. We're now taught that assimilation is a bad thing. And that it is triggering, and it's a bastion of white supremacy and all of this garbage.
Well, it's taught, but the reality is that after the first generation, the new coming Spanish speakers learn English, and English becomes a dominant language for the second generation Cuban Americans, and they become Americanized by the second generation, not the first.
Yeah, I agree with all that. Like, it is a wonderful trend, but it is a trend that needs help. You know, it needs people to say that this is a good part of the American story of assimilation. It is a good part. You know, we now get told that telling people to sort of blend into America is a form of cultural suicide or cultural genocide, which I think is monstrous. I love the immigration story in America, and I want to teach all of the bad things that have happened in American past, because the important part of the story, as you suggest, is that we overcame these things. And we should celebrate that we overcame these things. I want to teach about slavery. I absolutely want to teach about slavery, but not to say that slavery still defines America. But I want to teach about slavery to say, look, we overcame this horribly evil institution, and that is one of the things that makes America great. Almost every civilization in the world had slavery over the last 10,000 years. The remarkable thing about the West, and a lot of places still have slavery today, one of the remarkable things about the West isn't that we had slavery, but that we got rid of it. And instead, the way we teach American history is that these evil deeds are supposed to define America rather than our overcoming them should define America. And so, look, I very much am in favor of assimilation. I very much think that we are very lucky in how we handle assimilation on the ground. We do it much, much better than Europe does. But at the same time, it's important to celebrate the fact that we do that well, rather than just sort of take your hands off the wheel and say, oh, well, history will take its course. And I should say Putnam thought in the long run it would all work out. But in the medium, short and medium term can be a very long time. And when you have people on the right and the left telling a story about immigration that, you know, either says, you know, you have people like Trump and Trump's, you know, and certainly Bannon, who basically want to paint all immigrants as takers, as cheats, as criminals, and you have people on the left who want to treat all immigrants as if they are the latest members of the coalition of the oppressed, and that they need to be celebrated as victims rather than as sort of heroic people who are trying to get a fresh start. I don't like either of the ways that the left and the right talk about immigration today, but my point is simply that civil society is where people actually get civilized. And with family breakdown, with the erosion of mediating institutions, the erosion of religion in public life, the challenge to get people to sort of see themselves as full Americans, regardless of their color of their skin, regardless of their ethnic background, regardless of their sexual heritage, is made difficult by populist forces, but also by identity politics and by a whole slew of problems that we have. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is actually model the behavior that I think is increasingly lost on the right and make a good faith effort to try and persuade people on both the left and the right that a lot of them have lost their way.
Where do you think this Trump populism is taking us?
Not a great place. I think it's, you know, I as someone who prides himself on being, you know, a conservative, I think, you know, there's profound damage being done to conservatism because it's being turned into essentially, at least in this moment, a kind of cult of personality where the sort of William Jennings Bryan mode of argumentation triumphs. You know, I'm for it because Trump is for it. I'm against it because Trump is against it. And I find that kind of stuff maddening. I also think that, you know, again, sort of getting back to the entertainment point, I think the precedent he's setting, you know, for the country, but also particularly for liberals, is a problematic one because, you know, I remember saying in the summer of 2016 that, you know, if George Clooney or Oprah or Tom Hanks parachuted in and said they were running for president, they probably would have won because America didn't like the choices that they have. And for Republicans, I mean, our bench of celebrities kind of peters out at Scott Baio. Democrats have got a really deep bench of celebrities, and teaching the American people or setting the precedent that celebrity is a qualification for the highest office in the land, I think is a dangerous one, regardless of the partisan issues.
If Trump, let's say the Trump is the blob and he's taken over the Republican Party and every Republican he takes becomes part of the blob in that old Steve McQueen movie, are there any Republicans out there that represent the old values to say, look, the federal deficit is an important problem and we're going to stand by it. We're not going to increase the deficit, or we're not going to, we're going to be tough on countries like North Korea and we're going to be advocates of distrusting leaders like Kim Jong-un.
I think there are a lot of intellectual forces out there that are sort of holding their own, at National Review. We try to call balls and strikes, and we're not giving in on things like trade policy or any of that kind of stuff. Same thing with the Weekly Standard, which, is very tough on issues like entitlement reform and the debt. The conservative think tanks, for the most part, places like Cato and the American Enterprise Institute are remaining strong on this. The problem really is among the Republican elected leaders, and there are a handful that I think are still, trying their best to stay true to some principles. Ben Sasse, I think, leads that pack. The problem is that because of this cult of personality dynamic, the real litmus test isn't where you come down on policy for a lot of Republicans these days. The litmus test is whether or not you criticize or praise Donald Trump. And so people like, Jeff Flake, who's basically been pelted from public life because even though he voted, with the so-called Trump agenda quite a bit, as did, Corker from Tennessee and Mitch McConnell and Ben Sasse, even though they have great conservative ratings as senators, when Donald Trump would do something indefensible or say something indefensible, they wouldn't defend it, and instead they would criticize it. And that's what gets them in trouble with a lot of Republican voters these days and a lot of the sort of, pro-Trump pundits. It's telling that,
But does that say that people's loyalty to the party was really based on access to power and not on ideology?
No, I mean, I don't think that was always the case. I do think that sort of psychologically a lot has changed in the Republican Party and on the right in the last few years. I think some of it has to do, with the Obama years and the way the press covered the Obama years, where the press covered the Tea Parties. I think, I don't think Donald Trump is the author of all of our problems by any stretch of the imagination. And I will flatly and honestly say I agree with some of the things he's done. But Donald Trump is taking a lot of the problems that we have and making them worse. Our problems, he is downstream. Washington is downstream of a lot of our problems, but Washington is making a lot of those problems worse.
Well, Jonah Goldberg, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. I like talking movies with you. Do you have a movie recommendation? Anything you've seen? You didn't see the new Star Wars film, did you?
I did.
Yeah, what
did
you think?
I'm in the mushy middle on it. I thought it was fine. I have Star Wars nerds who despise it because it violated the canon in some way, and then there are other people who think it was fantastic, which I don't. I think it was pretty good. Not great, but pretty good.
Well, Jonah, thanks a lot. Come back and discuss politics and movies anytime.
Be my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jonah. That's Jonah Goldberg, who's a senior editor at the National Review and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's going to be speaking this coming Thursday at the Tiger Bay Club in St. Petersburg. And in order to get in, you've got to go to tigerbay.org, or you can find out more information at 727-822-1001. That's 727-822-1001. And thanks to Jonah Goldberg, his new book is all about tribalism in America, and the book is called Suicide of the West. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play those comments back on Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned because coming up next, Daniel Ruth, unfortunately, is on vacation. So we are going to hear the Tom Hartman Show live coming to us from Portland, Oregon today. And you'll be able to call Tom Hartman. I'll give you the number in just a few minutes. Before we do that, though, we're going to get some of the latest news from National Public Radio. Frank Knox has been our phone producer today. And if you missed our fund drive, we came up a bit short. We're still about $15,000 short. You can make a contribution at WMNF.org to keep this unique radio station on the air. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg.